The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 4. Past the halfway point of this 7-day session here in March 2017 at Mountain Gate in northern New Mexico. On a very windy day in spring, very windy, very cloudy at this point. It was full of sunshine this morning and now it's full of clouds. Things change. This is the one constant in the universe. Things change. Today I'd like to talk about something that is often anathema for people, and that is death and dying. We all are going to do it someday, some of us sooner, some of us later. Every morning we dedicate the morning chanting to one of our California students who has been facing for many years now, and she's only 31 years old, some serious byproducts caused by the fact that she's got two fatal autoimmune diseases. Very recently, she called me up. Actually, it was the day Sashin was to begin. She texted me. She didn't call me. She texted me very early in the morning, and her time zone, it was about 3:30 in the morning, to say she was in the hospital, and she named the hospital, thankfully, because I was able later to call, saying that she was in anaphylaxis again, and they were having a very difficult time getting her stabilized. She was in the cardiac ICU, intensive care unit, in that hospital. And they had already had to resuscitate her more than once. Her condition is that certain cells in her body attack the rest of her body. That's just one of the two autoimmune diseases she has. And even at the young age of 31, she has a feeding tube, and not only a feeding tube, but it's her second feeding tube. The first one was in her stomach, and that finally was attacked. That area was attacked, so it no longer was functioning, and so they had to put a feeding tube lower down in her intestinal tract. Then she has to have a feeding tube because her body has already destroyed her esophagus, so she cannot eat normally. She's also faced with some severe dietary restrictions in the sense that the fluid that is possible to receive through the feeding tube, there are various different versions of it, but the kind that would keep her most healthy is extremely expensive, and it's being refused to her. She's facing something that most of us don't have to face, fortunately, and she's been facing it for some years. This is not the first time her heart has stopped, nor the second or the third. We all will eventually face something if we continue practicing that is known as the great death. It can feel like dying, and it can come up with a great deal of fear. And so it's not uncommon for people who've been practicing seriously for some time to have fear starting to come up. This is actually a good sign because it means that we're not so far away as we were before in terms of coming to awakening. Coming to awakening is awakening to the truth of who we really are. In the meantime, were held by a self-image. A self-image is kind of a tyrant in many cases, and many times it is born of our experiences and the assumptions we've gathered about ourselves through those experiences. And so we come up with a self-image that isn't really reality. It's composed of many stories based on, as I said, our experiences in life and also what people have told us about ourselves. And yet, we hold on to this dearly. It drives us, and rather than living fully, we live constricted by needs to behave in certain ways. We have knee-jerk reactions to situations and things and people as a result of this self-image. What's the real truth? Who are we really? This is the fundamental question of our practice, whether it's in the mukoan, whether it's extending the out-breath and searching, we don't know what for, or whether it's actively searching for who we are. Fundamentally, the practice is the same. Trying to open to who and what we really are, because that frees us from the tyranny of this self-image. That freedom is beyond concepts. And if we go deeply enough, it allows us to live in a very different way than most people live. A couple of examples. Contemporary, essentially, examples. One is Flora Courtois, who went to the University of Michigan. She had her first year at university just before the great market crash of 1929. But before that, when she was 15 years old or so, she started collecting aphorisms, because she was fascinated by trying to understand how things happen and why. And she began to realize that every time something happened, something took place, and she'd run to her scrapbook and look up and discover that while there was a particular aphorism that may have been accurate before or during the situation, once the situation had changed, it no longer was accurate, it no longer fit. And so she began to wonder if there wasn't some underlying truth that was always true. This is not your usual way of questioning, but it was very effective, and it brought her to the same end. It became more and more intense, this questioning for her, particularly as she got into college, as she began to take courses in philosophy and psychology and other courses that seemed she might find some answer to it through. And she also went to her local parish priest. She was raised Catholic, and asked him, and he gave her a stack of books to read on dogma. She realized soon after that she was not going to find her answer in words. Not in the books that the priest gave her, not in the courses that she took. She could only find it within. And she continued to search deeply, more and more deeply, within. And eventually, through this intensive searching, and it took about a year and a half, she was sitting in her room at home on a vacation. I think it was a Thanksgiving vacation. Sitting on the edge of her bed, she glanced at her desk, and suddenly she wrote, "The world turned on its axis." And from then on, her life was different. an enormous measure of freedom opened up for her. She had been on a track of going for a PhD in psychology and downshifted to a master's degree because her priorities changed. She eventually got married and had a son, moved to California. She tried initially to find out what had happened to her. It seemed somehow related to eyesight. In fact, she eventually went to New York City to meet with the widow of Norman Bates, who had developed a system of developing eyesight for people who had weak eyes. And although she found Mrs. Bates a very kindly person, it gave her no answers. She had talked to her different professors throughout her process of searching, and still she found no answers. And eventually she decided that she would simply not speak of it to anyone until she found someone who could really understand what had happened to her. But as I said, her life changed. She found herself with a full measure of freedom and joy. Things were effortless for her. And eventually she found her way to Alan Watts' living room gatherings, where they discussed Zen, and began to realize that this thing called enlightenment was something that she had actually experienced. And then she was able to meet Yasutani Roshi, but she first encountered Mayazumi Taigen, who was Mayazumi sensei back then, and leading a small zazen group in the basement of a church. And she began training with him, doing zazen, and continued through the entire training, passing through every single koan that Mayazumi Roshi taught. And it wasn't until one day she was asked to drive some visiting priests up to Tassajara in Northern California, because Mayazumi was in Los Angeles, that she met Yasutani Roshi and began to think perhaps she could ask him about what had happened to her. And with Mayazumi translating, she told Yasutani Roshi her story. And he felt very strongly that she had had a genuine and deep Kensho experience, because this was 20 years later after it had happened, and it was still, he felt, quite alive and active in her life. I'm sorry for the background noise. We're in the midst of construction, and it's quite windy, and part of the portal roof has been removed in order to allow the scaffolding to be in place to work on the upper level. And it's flapping in the breeze when the wind gusts, making rather a loud noise because it's a metal roofing. At any rate, Yasutani Roshi asked her to write down the story of what had happened. And she was actually quite a good writer. In fact, she was making a living as a scientific writer, I believe, at one point in time. And so she wrote it down, and eventually Quest Publishing, which was an arm of the Theosophical Society, published the book as a little booklet, and it found its way to the Rochester Zen Center, where it was read by many people and inspired many, many people. That book is long out of print, and however, when Flora died, she willed the manuscript to Zen Center Los Angeles, and eventually they republished it as an add-on chapter to a book that had been published years before by ZCLA, Hazy Moon of Enlightenment. So if you want to read the full account of her experience, you can do that in her own words. And there may or may not be the afterword by Yasutani Roshi. I haven't read it in quite a while, so I don't remember. But the book is available, as far as I know, through Amazon.com. And in fact, if you go to Amazon.com and Google or search for Flora Courtois, you'll probably find that book. It's well worth reading. It's very inspiring. As part of our process of coming to awakening, as I said, we will encounter fear. And the fear is one of dying, really. Hence the expression so common in Zen, let go your hold on the cliff and leap, hands held high, into the fiery abyss, because it can feel just like that. A friend of mine, many, many years ago, at a sesshin in Mexico, had a Kensho experience, and she told me afterwards, we were both at that sesshin, that she honestly thought she was dying. She happened to be a therapist, and so she knew what to do with fear, which was to face it directly. And as part of that, I'd like to share something on that line in a book called Life Lessons by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And in it, she talks about a man. Let me see if I can catch this. A man named Troy, who had AIDS. And I'll just share it in her words. Troy, who had been living with AIDS for 3 years, and remember that in those days, back in the 1980s, AIDS was a death sentence, a sure death sentence. Many, many, many people died of AIDS. And it was a traumatic situation for pretty much all of them, because it was a disease that initially hit homosexual men. And so all manner of judgment came forth, particularly from the more fundamentalist religions, to the point where the AIDS Interfaith Network in Rochester, New York was formed, a network of churches in the area, because the fundamentalist churches were going into the hospital rooms of men dying with AIDS, passing out literature saying that they were being punished by God. It was a horrific, horrific situation. So these men were often despised and abandoned by their families. People everywhere feared AIDS, because it was such a terrible disease, really. Nowadays, it's possible to live with AIDS or HIV, which is a precursor to AIDS, for many, many, many years, because there are antiviral medications that extend the lifetime of people who have AIDS. And of course, it's also spread well beyond the homosexual communities. And intravenous drug users, drug addicts are another population that is highly susceptible to AIDS, which is another reason why it's been so despised and so looked down upon as a condition. At any rate, Troy, who had been living with AIDS for 3 years, considered himself lucky because he'd never been sick from the disease. Physically, Troy was doing well. But mentally, he was paralyzed by fear. He was used to garden variety fear, having lived with it most of his life. It had never been paralyzing, he explained, just bad enough to keep me a distance from life. Now with AIDS, I was devastated. It was like all my fears had consolidated themselves into one big disease. My partner, Vincent, is always supportive. He keeps telling me that I'm stronger than my fears. Just step forward, he says, face them. Just step forward, face them. And this is what we are called upon to do in our practice as well. When fear comes up, our normal reaction most likely is to try to turn away from it, get rid of it, do something different. But in reality, the most effective thing to do is walk right into it. Feel it. Taste it. Get to know it intimately. If it gets to be too much, back out for a while and go back in. It will make all the difference in your life. Take your worst fear to lunch and you'll find it doesn't have the power over you that you think it does. This is what Vincent had told Troy. And it is true. Take your worst fear to lunch and you'll find it doesn't have the power over you that you think it does. I thought, face my fears? Take them to lunch? Step forward? Isn't it enough that I'm living with AIDS? The truth is, I would much rather take issue with what he said than look at it. No one knew more than me how much my fears ate me alive. I was between jobs when one of Vince's co-workers approached me. He told me his sister Jackie had AIDS and had just been released from the hospital. They were having a hard time getting anyone to help her, and I wondered if I would. I told him I'd think about it and call him back. Then I went to Vincent for his advice, and he said, she desperately needs the help, and you could use the money. I asked him how sick he was, and he said he thought she was dying. When he said that, every fear I had rose up within me. I asked, does everyone think I'm uniquely qualified to take care of her because I'm dying? No, Vincent said. They're hoping you might not be afraid of the disease because you have it. Boy, I thought, if they got the wrong person. I couldn't commit to it. I was too afraid. Vincent reminded me I didn't have to do it if I didn't want to, but he thought I should meet her. I was afraid to. Then I thought I'd been afraid long enough, so I decided to step forward and meet her. I asked Vincent to go with me to her house. I walked up to her door, turned around and said, Vincent, I'm sorry, I can't do it. He said, okay, let's go home and call him. But I looked at her door again. There, right through the door, were all my fears. I decided to walk into them and just see what happens. Something made me go through that door. Inside, I looked at her sitting in a wheelchair. She must have weighed 80 pounds. She'd suffered a double stroke, so she couldn't speak very well. She had the biggest brown eyes I had ever seen. I looked into them and I saw all this fear there. It was written on her forehead. I'm afraid I'm dying. I'm afraid I will die alone. I'm afraid no one will be there for me. I'm afraid you will leave. There were my biggest fears sitting right in front of me. I looked at her and was so sad. I just kept hearing in my mind, step forward, just step into your fear. I closed my eyes and asked, can I start today? I knew I needed to help her, this stranger I didn't know. Later, I found out that her parents wanted nothing to do with her now that she had AIDS. They wanted to pay someone to deal with it. They were just waiting for her to die. She had a couple of friends who came over, but not that often. I went from helping part-time to working full-time to being her best friend. I didn't expect to move through my fears, yet I did. I came to love her. Toward the end, she was hospitalized again. She wanted me there because she was so frightened. On her last day, I went in. The hospital had called her parents, but they stayed in the waiting room. I sat with her, looking at those big brown eyes. I told her I was with her. I could feel her fear. I had never felt anything so intense. Then it popped into my head again. Step forward. It has no power. I told her, I'm holding your hand. I'm going to stay here and hold your hand until they take you on the other side. Then they'll hold your hand. No fears, Jackie. No fears. And then she died. I watched her chest stop moving up and down. The mortuary came to pick her up. They were upset that no one had told them she had AIDS, and they were afraid to touch her. So a nurse and I volunteered to put Jackie in the body bag. I was tired of feeling fear around her. I thought, no more. I would rather do it myself than let them near her. It was the hardest thing I had ever done in my life. I just kept saying to her, no fears, Jackie, no fears. At a certain point in my own life, a tremendous fear began to rise. And because of my experience in the past with working with things like that, I turned and faced it, felt it. Felt it as completely as I could. By that time, I had discovered the book Focusing, which is an excellent book, by the way. It's a very good book for any Zen student to read and to take to heart and to follow its instructions. It tells you exactly how to work with all manner of difficult feelings, fear, anger, frustration, even blankness, even feelings you don't even know what you're feeling. So I tuned in, felt the fear. When it would get close to overwhelming, I would back out. I had this image in my mind of trying to ice skate across a frozen lake that was not entirely frozen. And I would gingerly move one foot out, and the ice would crack. And I'd stop and feel it. And then I'd move the other foot out, and the ice would crack. At any moment, the lake could swallow me up. But then I would move the other foot out, and again, the ice would crack. And then I would move that other foot out again, and again, the ice would crack. And it went this way for days and weeks and months. And eventually I realized I was across that lake. Not only that, but when fear came up, it was absolutely no problem at all. It had no bite to it any longer. And eventually it just stopped coming up. But at the beginning, it was close to paralyzing. This is a lesson for everyone. Just like Troy, turn around and walk into it. But you have to walk into it like that saying, let go your hold on the cliff. Drop into it. Your greatest fear. Drop into it. Fear will come up at certain points in our practice. This is how to work with it. And in Kaplaroshi's second book, his first being the Three Pillars of Zen, his second book is called The Wheel of Death, a collection of writings from Zen, Buddhist, and other sources on death, rebirth, and dying. It's long out of print, and many decades later, I was Kaplaroshi's secretary when he wrote a replacement for that book, a much thicker book, originally called The Wheel of Life and Death. I think eventually the publisher changed the title, but there were some significant stories in here that changed my life and put me on the path of Zen at a time when everything had vanished. Everything that mattered to me, everything I identified with, everything that I thought made me, shattered at my feet. And somebody handed me this book. Four chapters. Death, Dying, Karma, and Rebirth. I read it cover to cover in one sitting. And the next morning, sat down and crossed my legs in Zazen for the first time. I was challenged by how the people mentioned in this book were able to face death so fearlessly. Socrates, "To fear death, gentlemen, is none other than to think oneself wise when one is not. For it is to think one knows what one does not know. No man knows whether death may not even turn out to be the greatest of blessings for a human being. And yet people fear it, as if they knew for certain that it is the greatest of evils." And he said this on his deathbed. Socrates, as you probably already know, was sentenced to death by poison. And he said this to his students who were gathered around him wailing. "Apollonius of Tyana, there is no death of anyone but only in appearance, even as there is no birth of anyone save only in seeming. A change from being to becoming seems to be birth. A change from becoming to being seems to be death. But in reality, no one is ever born, nor does one ever die." No one is ever born, nor does one ever die. That's exactly what the Buddha said. And yet, certainly we know people who die, who have died, and it's like if you've seen a dead body, you know it's dead. And you know that person is not going to get up and walk around and talk to you anymore. And you know, as you get older, that that same thing is going to happen to you. So what is this? No, death. Eternal, joyous, selfless, pure. This is our being. As one Catholic priest who had a deep Kensho experience after many, many years of meditation wrote, "We are the outpressing of God. We are the outpressing of God." He didn't say we're separate. He said we are the outpressing of God. We are an expression of life itself, with a capital L. Epictetus, "And what is the end of the illness? Nothing worse than death. Will you realize once for all that it is not death that is source of all man's evils, but rather the fear of death? Against this fear, then, I would have you discipline yourself. To this let all your reasonings, your lectures, and your trainings be directed. And then you will know that only so do men achieve their freedom." And Ramana Maharshi, who had a profound awakening experience when he suddenly had a fear of death when he was a teenager. "Owing to the I am the body notion, death is feared as being the loss of oneself," and capital O. "Birth and death pertain to the body only, but they are superposed on the self, giving rise to the delusion that death and birth relate to the self," and the self is a capital S. "Why do you mourn the loss of your parents? I shall tell you where they are. They are only within ourselves and are ourselves. For the life current has passed through innumerable incarnations, births and deaths, pleasures and pains, etc., just as the water current in a river flows over rocks, pits, sands, elevations, and depressions on its way, but is still the current is unaffected. Again, the pleasures and pains, births and deaths are like undulations on the surface of seeming water in the mirage of the ego. The only reality is the self, with a capital S, from where the ego appears and runs through thoughts that manifest themselves as the universe, and in which the mothers and fathers, friends and relatives appear and disappear. They are nothing but manifestations of the self, with a capital S. And when he speaks of ego here, he's talking about the self-image. And back to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, she talks about a couple. Who had been married for decades, and the wife was dying. Frank and Margaret had been married for over 50 wonderful years. Devotedly in love with each other, they were inseparable. When Margaret became terminally ill, she said, "I can accept this illness. I can accept that I'm going to die. The hardest thing for me to accept is that I'm going to be without Frank." As Margaret's disease progressed, she was more and more disturbed by the prospect of this ultimate separation. But hours before she died, she turned to Frank, who was sitting at her bedside. Her mind was clear and alert, for she'd taken no medications. She said, "I'm going to be leaving soon, and it's finally okay." "What has made it okay for you?" he asked. "I've just been told I'm going to a place where you already are. You will be there when I get there." This practice brings us, eventually, if we stick with it and we go deeply enough, face to face with all of these experiences. And if we continue on bravely embracing the fear, something called total liberation awaits us. It is beyond description. It is the birthright of every one of us. Countless human beings have experienced it and lived through that and brought it to life in their everyday lives since at least the Buddha, more than 2,500 years ago, began to teach how to reach it after his own deep awakening experience. This is the promise, the true promise held out to each one of you here in the Zendo. Persist long enough, deep enough, with enough commitment, and it will open to you. No question about it. Take this to heart. We have really less than 3 days left in the Sesshin. Give everything to it. Your capacity is so much greater than even a few minutes ago, much less several days ago. That means it's easier to go deeper, though it may not seem like it. Trust that the path is more clear than it was at the beginning because you've removed some obstacles already. This is a practice we often must do blindly, in faith that if we persist, it will unfold for us and we will reach that liberation because it is true. Thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.